Roses are red, green is the clover. A long dry season is almost over. The Labor Day weekend is one last occasion for a few more things of the summer persuasion. Welcome to Spectrum West, everybody. You are going to enjoy and be careful during this upcoming long weekend, are you not? Good. We're about to introduce you to some interesting folks on this edition of Spectrum West, where the arts and culture of West Wisconsin come alive on the radio. This week, we'll tour the studio of stained glass artist Michael Pila, who spends time in Menominee restoring windows and doors and capturing rainbows and prisms within frames of his own imagining. Mr. Jim Oliver stops by with what's on stage in West Wisconsin, also brings us the story and music of the Bavarian Music Meisters coming east from Minneapolis to help us celebrate Oktoberfest in Chippewa Falls. Jeff Peterson is here with a glance at the approaching season for the Chippewa Valley Jazz Orchestra, nearing a 10-year anniversary of cool live music. That is some of what's on tap today. And this is where we start the ball rolling. Spring and fall are typically when arts groups invite us all to take a road trip, to stop at galleries and workshops and studios to view artistic creations and meet the creators. One such trip is the Yellowstone Art Trail. It beckons us next weekend, Friday and Saturday. To get necessary details and background, we called Gene Arneson, an artist and tour originator who lives near Cadott. Everything from soap to nuts. And if you consider things used by Vic Rulo in his rustic lawn art, that's where the nuts can come in. So
that's perfect.
This is your fifth year, I hear.
It is, yes.
How has it evolved since the first year?
The first year we had the towns of Cadott, Boyd, and Stanley and on the art trail. It was a lot of driving, so we wanted to condense it a little bit, and plus we ended up getting more artists over west of us in the eastern part of Lake Wissota. So we changed the route. That first year we had 13 or 14 locations, and last year we had 15. Now we're down to 9, but we've condensed more people at each location.
That kind of makes sense.
We have new signs this year. They're bigger. It would be easier to see them because some of them were just handmade signs, which were nice. They were arrow signs, but sometimes here out in the rural area, you have these big ditches. You can't see the signs very well. We'd have to dress them up with balloons and things, so we have different signage. Every year we have newer artists, and some drop out for various reasons, and we've added new business sponsors. Mm-hmm. We like to keep the historical part going, too, with the Bohemian Hall and the Cadott Area Historical Society, and they both give tours of their buildings during the art trail also.
So as it evolves, because, you know, there are a whole bunch of art tours around.
There are.
They happen in the spring and the fall, which I guess is a testament to all the neat people that live in western Wisconsin. So you have the first one. Then what happens? You have other artists say, you know, I heard about your deal. I'd like to be part of it. Is that how it grows?
Yep, that's how it grows. And a lot of times we go around and visit different art shows and events and invite artists that we're really interested in their artwork. And we've gotten a few that way also. That's where we get in new artists and keep some of the old favorites that we've had around since the very beginning. We've got quite a few of those, too,
good,
that keep improving on their work, too, as well, making new things and keeping it interesting for the art trail.
Since you have the resolve to come on the radio, you get the perk of promoting who you are and what you do. You credit people like Hugh Mondaler as a mentor.
Oh, yes.
Kind of a prominent art figure in these parts. What kinds of things did he impart that furthered your career?
Well, he was very instrumental in getting me started with my own art business. He's a professional artist, and he had many years' experience as a textile designer in New York City.
Mm-hmm.
And when he came here, he started up art classes. So I started taking classes with him when I was only 18 years old. He's just a wonderful teacher as far as instructing on the oil painting and how to develop your own style.
Mm-hmm.
He appreciated everyone's own style. And he knew a lot of the business aspects of it, too, so how to promote yourself and get your name out, too. I learned so much from him, and also my high school art teacher, Dan McCreary. With both of those teachers and the camaraderie from the fellow students, critiquing our work and helping each other out, learning more about the art world, and
sure,
we'd go take trips. to the Art Institute and other art galleries and learn more that way, too. And it was just a lot of fun. And now I'm also involved in the Valley Art Association.
Yeah.
Excited that we're going to have our grand opening soon at the Valley Art Gallery. And it's going to be opening next week, but we're going to have an official grand opening sometime later in October, I believe it is.
Good for you. Now, I've always wondered the difference between painting on a small canvas and painting on a huge exterior wall, like the one that you worked on in Chippewa Falls.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you're painting on a canvas, you can stand back and look. And you know, on a wall, it's completely mm-hmm. different. I mean, the scale is just so weird. How do you adjust to that?
I adjust to that by, on a grand scale, by gridding the wall. I'll grid the design I'm working on and just kind of follow the squares like that because it's so big. We number it and letter it, number across, letter vertically, and then you just kind of find the square that you need to draw things in because you're up so close, you got to keep looking back and forth. And I know some people, they've been able to use an overhead projector, but that wasn't possible in this case. And it was a totally different painting medium. I paint with oils. It takes a while for the oil paint to dry, and you have real flexibility with blending and leaving the painting sit and coming back to it, and it's still wet, and you can work with it. Whereas the wall mural, we used latex paint, which dries very quickly, and especially when you're working in the heat. Some of the days were pretty hot, and so it's a little bit different style of blending, and you can't really blend much. You do more layering and dry brushing and that kind of thing. That in itself is a whole different way of coming at it, too.
I mean, you can take a couple steps back when you're working on a canvas, but you maybe have to go across the street.
Yeah. Yes, you have to wait for the traffic first, and then go across the street and take a look.
The Wagner Street mural in Chippewa Falls, the one I was reading about, is that the one that goes up the hill or at the bottom of the hill?
Okay. Yes, it goes up the hill.
That's on Business, what, 29 there?
Off of Business 29.
Okay. On the phone with Gene Arneson, the Yellowstone Art Trail. It's the 5th annual art tour. It's Friday and Saturday, September 7th and 8th. That is in the Lake Wissota and Chippewa County area. 9 locations, 27 artists. That's cool. Now, Gene, you were one of the instigators of the Yellowstone Art Trail. The tour is named after an actual trail running from Plymouth, Massachusetts to Seattle, Washington, and it runs through Wisconsin from Kenosha all the way to Hudson, including a stretch through Chippewa and Eau Claire counties. Was that something that you were real cognizant of? Are you a fan of the Yellowstone Trail, thus you named the art tour after it?
Well, we've seen those signs around town with the Yellowstone Trail, and you're kind of interested, wanted to know what that was all about. So I did a little research on that. And then when a couple friends and myself, Renee Rickle and Kathy Solacek, we have been going to different art places for years, different art shows and art crawls and art galleries, and we really kind of wanted to start something here ourselves. And so when we sat down to come up with a name with it, one of us said, well, what about the Yellowstone Art Trail? Because this area isn't so known for the Yellowstone Trail, and that just fit just perfectly.
Yeah.
And then my husband came up with, follow the Yellowstone Road. So we added that into
cool.
our logo, Follow the Yellowstone Road Art Trail.
So that's how
we got our name.
Yeah, cool. Now, it's separated, as you have said earlier, into 9 locations at which 27 artists display their work. It'll be much easier and less time-consuming to name the 9 locations, and then people can go online to see who's at each location. So what are the 9 locations?
Okay, the 9 locations, we have the Anson Methodist Church. I'm going to say them in order that they are on the route. That's number 1. Number mm-hmm. 2 is Devana Broat. Number 3, Heidi Brezina. Number 4, Andrea Richardson. Number 5, the Cadott Area Historical Society. Number 6, the Bohemian Hall. Number 7 is my studio, Gene Arneson. Number 8, Gene Adder Koala. And number 9 is the Institute of St. Joseph Nazareth Studio. And all these locations, there's only 2 that have 1 artist at. The rest of them have 2 or more.
Okay.
And the Bohemian Hall and the Anson Methodist Church each have 6 artists. The Nazareth Studio has 4.
Mm-hmm.
So you'll see more artists there at each location.
The website is yellowstonearttrail.blogspot.com. You're also on Facebook. At that location and those locations, will people be able to get a map? How do they get that stuff?
Yes, each artist has brochures, and the businesses, if you see our brochure on the website, you'll see which businesses we feature on there that are sponsors of the art trail. And we couldn't do it without them and our artists, of course.
Sure.
And so they can view the map on the website, and they can pick up brochures at any of those locations or from the artists themselves.
What are the hours on those two dates?
The hours are 9 o'clock in the morning to 5 p.m. both days. And since it's our fifth anniversary, we wanted to do something a little different, a little more special. So the Institute of St. Joseph, the Nazareth Studio, which is in Boyd, that's the number 9 stop on the art tour, they are going to have free family-friendly events on the Saturday of the art tour, which is September 8th, and that's from 12:30 to 3:30, jewelry and soap making, paper craft products, and there'll be free face painting. And Donna Thies from Paint Me First Professional Face Painting will be there ready to transform the little kiddos into fairies and monsters and other things, and adults, too, if they want to have their faces painted. So
yeah.
Come on, check that out on that day, too.
I've never done that. I should get my face painted one of these days.
No, she does a wonderful job.
Oh, cool. I mean, a face like mine just isn't that good of a canvas, but oh, well.
Well, you'd be surprised.
Sometimes they make pretty faces look scary, and other times they make scary faces look pretty. So
there you go.
I probably would be the latter. I'm guessing on that. We
well,
should also,
I don't know about that.
The Valley Art Gallery that you alluded to earlier, that's opening soon, is in Chippewa Falls.
Correct. Right downtown on Bridge Street.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Very cool. Jean Arneson, the Yellowstone Art Trail, thanks for being with us on Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me on.
Spectrum West on Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for joining us. Support for WPR comes from the Minnesota Marine Art Museum in Winona with Annie Haney Waterlines, featuring textured abstract paintings by the Minnesota-born visual artist, on view now. More at mmam.org. Support also comes from Simply Done in Downsville, a place for gifts, ideas, and space for events. Home of Dunn County Pottery, featuring wood-fired pottery and fair trade gifts. More at simply-dunn.com. Music of Wayne Bergeron, guest artist for the first concert and new season of the Chippewa Valley Jazz Orchestra. Jeff Peterson was there at the beginning and remains a delegate as the 10-year mark approaches. Before we define the new season, let's go back to the beginning. There was a first concert at the Heidi Center in February of 2010, and to say it went well is an understatement, because a full season followed shortly thereafter. And Mr. Peterson will pick it up from there.
You know, we started this, because it really starts in 2009 is when we really started thinking about it and planning for it. It was a bunch of us sitting around at the joint, and we were saying, you know, we play all these wedding gigs, and God, we're sick of playing Pennsylvania 65,000 and in the mood over and over and over again. And so we came up with this idea of, you know, how do we do legitimate, great big band jazz in a format that doesn't require a wedding or a bar mitzvah or something like that. And so we sort of did a model that was a combination of what, for example, the symphony does, right, where we wanted to do these sort of set concerts. But we also based the organization on a group actually out of my hometown, Fargo, North Dakota, called the FM Jazz Collective. And it was a bunch of high school band directors and local musicians who put together this big band that had been doing the same sort of set concert pieces, bringing in guest artists. And they'd been doing it for, you know, 25, 30 years at that point. And we thought, well, you know, maybe we've got something here, maybe we don't. We came up with a list of sort of all of the musicians, you know, who's our first ask for every single spot in the band.
Okay.
And we thought, well, let's see what happens. Let's see how many of them say yes. And essentially all of them did. And we thought, okay, well, this is a good sign. There's clearly a bunch of musicians who want to do this. So let's find out if there's any demand to actually hear it. right? And so, and the Heidi Center show turned out to be much more successful than we thought. A lot of people showed up for it, and we thought, okay, we've hit on something here.
Okay.
So, yeah, we're coming up on a 10th anniversary here pretty quickly at this point. So, yeah.
So how did the band of 2010 compare with today's version?
Well, the funny thing is there's a lot of the same people still in
it. Is it?
And that's, I think, a testament to how much the people in the band love doing this kind of music. I would say that we are more adventurous now. We're more, I mean, when we first started out, we wanted to do what we could to bring in an audience. You know, okay, we're going to do Benny Goodman. We're going to do Count Basie. We're going to do Duke Ellington. You know, the stuff that we know is likely to attract an audience. And I think now we are at, we're comfortable enough with our position that we're willing to do things that are a little, you know, sometimes more challenging. Bring in someone like Keith Carnes as a guest artist who is, you know, really at the forefront of modern big band composition. And yeah, some of that stuff is, you've got to think pretty hard. You know, it's the difference between listening to Bach and listening to Stravinsky. You know, I mean, it's, yeah. Stravinsky challenges you more. And it's not that we go out of our way, but, you know, it's I think there's a certain comfort level now in knowing that we've got an audience that is willing to go with us on these journeys and try new music that maybe they haven't heard before. So
it's a lot more fun, is what you're saying.
Exactly. You know, I mean, we did the all 70s music show a couple of years ago, and that was like, that was just a total flyer. It's like, are people going to like this or not? We have no idea. It turned out to be an enormous amount of fun.
Good.
You know, and so I think we're a little more comfortable in our own skin now. So.
Tell me if I'm right. I think everyone in every musical aggregation in Western Wisconsin of note is eager to find out what they sound like as their sound reverberates through the new Pablo Center.
It's going to be an experience. You know, we don't really know what to expect. Obviously, it's an amazing facility. There's a lot of things to like about it. At the same time, it's going to be a completely new experience for us. You know, we're used to playing in the state, and the state theater, you know, holds 1,200 people. The theater we're going to be playing in at Pablo holds slightly under 400 people.
Yeah.
So it's a different kind of space in that sense. It's going to be smaller. It's going to have a somewhat more intimate feel to it. But it's also acoustically designed for these kind of performances, whereas the state was designed to be a vaudeville house.
It's kind of a big room for just 400 people.
It's big and it's not. I mean, yeah, it's big in terms of the actual physical space, but it's still obviously a lot smaller than what the state theater was. So, you know, I think it's going to be fun. I think it's going to be a lot of fun to play there. But that first show could be we're way too loud, or oh, no one can hear us. So, you know, we're going to have to find out. And that's going to be part of the excitement, I'm sure.
Chippewa Valley Jazz Orchestra season. That's our topic. And our guy is Jeff Peterson. Good to have him here. Tickets are now available, by the way. We should let people know.
We should.
That first, and we will. October 19th is your first show. Wayne Bergeron is coming, and from what I read, he was here the first year.
Wayne has actually been here twice.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
He was officially our very first guest artist, and then we had him back again in 2014. When we started planning our first season at Pablo, we're like, okay, if we're going to bring back any of the old guest artists, Wayne's the one we've got to bring back. First of all, because he's an incredible trumpet player. I mean, he is off the charts good. If anybody went to see the new Incredibles movie over the summer, you got to hear his screaming lead trumpet part all the way through that. He's insanely talented.
When you land the position of lead trumpet chair in Maynard Ferguson's band?
Yes.
Pretty good trumpet player there on his own.
One would think.
Probably pretty good.
And also an incredibly nice guy. He's a lot of fun to work with. Okay. He'll be doing a master class for local high school trumpet players. He'll also be doing one over at the university. Cool. He's funny. He's fun. And I've never heard a trumpet player able to do what he does. We had to bring him back. He was an obvious choice.
Then December 7th and 8th, Bruce Herring's coming home as guest musical director. Mm-hmm. He's familiar with this territory as a high school teacher and had his own little group, maybe still does. Is he in Madison, though?
He's living in Madison. He was actually our original musical director way back in the beginning.
Cool.
The CVJO is sort of his and my baby in many ways. After Bruce retired, he moved to Madison, but we decided we wanted to do this joint concert with the symphony again. Mm-hmm. We had done one several years ago where the symphony would play movements from Tchaikovsky's Nutcracker Suite, and then we would play the Ellington versions of those. And so we'd go back back and forth between the two. And we sort of expanded the show a little bit now. So we're still going to do the Nutcracker, but then we're also going to do a few other great pieces of classical music that have been arranged for big bands as well. We're going to do two shows that Friday night and then that Saturday afternoon, joint concerts with the CVSO. And I think it's going to be an absolute blast.
And a couple months later, Wisco in the House. February 23rd, Wisconsin natives coming home to show us where they've been and how it's made them complete musicians. Andy Neasley and Mel Flannery.
Both Andy and Mel have performed with us before, not at the same time. You know, Andy was a UW-Eau Claire grad, went off to New York, was an associate director of the jazz program at the Manhattan School of Music, a variety of other things. Mm-hmm. And Mel is originally from the Appleton area, if I remember correctly, and then moved out to New York to pursue her singing career. And so they didn't actually really know each other till they both got to New York and discovered their Wisconsin connection and that sort of thing. And when we brought Andy back as a composer in residence in 2013, he said, "You need to get Mel Flannery out here at some point. She's an amazing singer." We brought her out a couple of years ago. And we thought, you know, why not do sort of a Wisconsin themed show? Let's bring these two back. Putting them together in the same show seemed like a logical fit to us.
So wear your cheese hats to that one.
Yes, definitely wear your cheese hats. And best cheese hat wins of.
Oh, yeah, you got to do that. In May, on the 3rd, the trombone helps us celebrate Spring Trombone Orama, which can sound a little R-rated if you don't add a bit of a pause.
That's absolutely true, and that's sort of the intent.
A guy named Andy Martin, who's quite a trombone player.
He is. Andy is the lead trombone player for Gordon Goodwood's Big Fat Band out on the West Coast.
That's P-H-A-T.
P-H-A-T. He's in many ways sort of the Wayne Bergeron of the trombone. He's the first call trombone player out there for movie and television music, touring bands, you name it. Andy was here at Jazz Fest in Oklahoma. Claire, and we felt really lucky that he was available, and we're hoping to bring in a couple of other local trombone talents. I'm not going to name names yet they're committed, but we're hoping to really turn it into a trombone-orama and get a whole bunch of really talented local trombone players up there all going after each other. It should be a lot of fun.
No kidding. That is May 3rd. We should also point out that in addition to supporting the jazz orchestra through buying tickets and coming to events, you can also donate.
Absolutely. We have what we call a continuing membership program. If they make a donation to the organization, you know, they get recognized in the program. We arrange special events with the guest artists, so you get a chance to do a meet and greet. But, you know, primarily it's there to help us fund the programming that we want to do. I mean, guest artists cost money. When we ask them to come in and do clinics in the high schools, or when we send our people out to do clinics in the high schools, you know, we have to have a certain level of support to make that happen. It's great to see that people in the community are willing to help out. You know, we couldn't do this without the people who come to our shows, but we also can't do it without the people who become part of our annual membership campaign.
How do they do that?
All they've got to do is go to our website, which is chippewajazz.org, and all of the information is there.
Exciting season coming up. Jeff Peterson, thanks.
Thank you.
More Wayne Bergeron music for you. Reminding you, the website is chippewajazz.org. Here's a reminder for you. The Chippewa Valley Youth Symphony invites young musicians entering 7th to 12th grades to audition for the upcoming 38th season. How impressive is that? Thursday and Friday, September 6th and 7th, between 4:30 and 6 p.m. at the Haas Fine Arts Center on the UWEC campus. Information online at cvyouthsymphony.org. You know, a little bird told me that Jim Oliver was quite a dancer in his kick-up-your-heels-at-a-wedding days. Plus, he played the accordion at one time and another. So this week's conversation will probably fill his stein to the brim.
The Oktoberfest celebration in Chippewa Falls is just around the corner. Festivities will begin Friday, September 14th, and run through Sunday, September 16th. There will be food, beverages, adult and otherwise, and lots of music. One of the musical groups is the Bavarian Music Meisters from the Twin Cities. The group will play on Friday, September 14th, beginning at 3:30 p.m. Joining us by telephone somewhere across the border to the west is one of the co-directors of the group, Aaron Jacobs. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
How did the Bavarian Music Meisters get started?
Well, the band started in 1985. It was a group of individuals that wanted to start a traditional Germanic-style group. They wanted to model it after, called a town band over in Germany, known as a Blaskapelle, or a brass or wind band. That is made up of roughly 30 members or 30 different instruments, 30 different players. And the band has grown since 1985. We now have roughly 35 members at any one time, and we've introduced some vocalists over time. So we perform throughout the year, beginning early April, and then our season concludes at the end of Oktoberfest season.
So how long have you been involved?
I've been with group for approximately 11 years now.
Now, you gave me some information on your the development of your musical career, how you got started playing, and your work with the trumpet and the flugelhorn.
I started playing trumpet like a lot of young players in the fifth grade, playing in the concert band, and then I played throughout high school, pep band, jazz band, orchestra. Went on to college and decided to put the horn away. I had enough of that. After I got out of college, I got married and saw a need for some music to be played at our church. Started a little group there, a little brass ensemble, and shortly after that, I joined a community band in the Anoka area. But I wanted to do something a little more spicy, a little more flavor, because I studied my genealogy and family history in college and admired my grandparents' German history. They loved to listen to the radio station. They always had polka music blaring from their farm porch.
That sounds so familiar.
So one day I was looking on Craigslist and just seeing what was out there for music groups, and I found this Bavarian Music Meisters ad and responded to it and joined them for a rehearsal, and I've been with the band ever since.
Well, we're going to take a break here just a minute, and we're going to listen to some of the music. This is from the concert that you did at the Amana Colonies in Iowa. I'm translating it because I can't pronounce it as it's listed, but anyway, it's the Village Tavern Polka. Bavarian Music Meisters from the Twin Cities. Joining us by telephone, one of the co-directors of the group, Aaron Jacobs. So how do you recruit musicians?
It seems that we recruit the best ways just from word of mouth, or people come to our concerts and they see how much fun we're having up on stage and interacting with our crowds, and they say, well, you know, hey, I could pick up my horn again, or I've been playing in other groups, and you know, they just see what kind of fun we're having, and oftentimes they sit in with us and they join us. So we're always looking for new players.
Mm-hmm. Now, are there special requirements that people have to meet in order to join the group?
Well, you have to know your instrument well, you know, be proficient at your instrument. There are no tryouts. We just ask that you, you know, can learn the music relatively quickly, and that's basically it. It's not a group that you have to try out for or audition. It's just out of love of music and love to play your instrument.
I read somewhere the members have to provide their own costume, so to speak.
Yeah, that's correct. A lot of people start out just as a substitute, and the band Lederhosen for the men. But then after, if you want to become a member, then you are required that you have to purchase your own outfit.
Now, in the picture that I saw, I don't see any accordions. What is there a limitation on what instruments people can bring to the group?
Well, as a brass capelle, there are no accordions or concertinas. It is a brass wind group.
Mm-hmm.
But the band features trumpets, clarinets, flutes, trombones, tubas, a drum set, and euphonium. And then the two instruments that are unique to our band that give it the flavor is the flugelhorn, plays similar as a trumpet, but it's more mellow. And the other instrument is a tenor horn, which kind of resembles the sound of a French horn.
How large of a group is going to be performing in Chippewa Falls?
I would expect that we'll have about 30 players there. We played there last year, and there was a good representation of the group, and I would expect that we would be doing the same this year in 2018.
How wide of an area do you perform? Where all do you travel to perform?
The furthest south we usually go is the Amana Colonies in Iowa. So we've got a couple concerts that we do out in the St. Cloud area, and then we've gone as far north as the Two Harbors area. And Chippewa Falls right now is about as far east as we go.
Tell us about what your duties are as a co-director.
Well, I put together the programs for each of our concerts, and I work along with my partner. We also are always looking for new music. So we do a lot of YouTube, see what other groups are playing, and then we try to find and add material to our own repertoire. And then a big part of it is, you know, running the rehearsals and, of course, conducting and directing the group during the performance and interacting with the crowd and doing the emceeing and getting the people involved in the music. And a lot of our music that we do during Oktoberfest includes a fair amount of singing along or clapping or shunkling, as you all find out in a short time from now.
This just occurred to me. First of all, have you ever traveled to Europe to perform, and have you ever considered doing that?
We've looked at traveling several years ago, but the cost for doing that is pretty hard, especially for the large group of people that are involved.
Mm-hmm.
And we've considered it, and we really like to do it, but getting the funds to do so is not been something that we've been able to harness yet.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've been talking to Aaron Jacobs, who is a co-director of the Bavarian Music Meisters, performing at the Oktoberfest in Chippewa Falls from 3:30 to 6:30 p.m. Friday, September 14th. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
And we'll go out with Ein Prosit.
Now, full lineup is online at gochippewafalls.com/events/Oktoberfest. Good stuff. Now, if you're wondering what's on stage in Western Wisconsin, the man to ask is still in the house. Here again is Jim Oliver.
Thanks, Al. The Phipps Center for the Arts in Hudson will present A Nice Family Gathering, opening Friday, September 7th. The show will run Fridays, Saturdays, and Sundays through September 23rd. Almost Maine will be staged September 14th to the 16th and the 21st and the 22nd in the St. Croix Art Barn in Osceola. The St. Croix Off-Broadway Dinner Theater of Hudson will open same time next year, Friday, September 14th. The show will run Fridays and Saturdays through October 27th. And the Red Barn Theater of Rice Lake will present Population 485. The final show of the season for the Red Barn will run through Saturday. For Spectrum West, I'm Jim Oliver.
Support for WPR comes from Art Z Gallery, an artist collective in Amory, Wisconsin, a gathering place to experience and share original art with monthly member and guest exhibits and classes in the arts. More at artzgallery.org. Here's a Spectrum memo for you. The 6x6 reading series is presented by the Chippewa Valley Writers Guild, wherein six local writers read from original work for 6 minutes. The first is Tuesday, September 4th, 7 p.m. at the local store, cvwritersguild.org. You know, it's funny how one thing and one person can lead to another thing and another person. Last week, we talked about Tai Chi. I was interested in following up. Turns out there's a Tai guy in Menominee, and it turns out even further that he's also quite an accomplished stained glass artist. A double whammy. I'd never visited a stained glass studio, so guess what I did? I hightailed it to Menominee. Monarch Studio, where Michael Pila maintains a very impressive reputation as original artist, plus sought-after specialist in preservation and restoration.
This is quite a big workshop.
Yeah, what happens with stained glass people is that we need horizontal space. You have to lay things out. You've got windows that you have to lay out. You've got patterns or drawings that you have to lay out. So you need room for both storage, but also work surfaces, multiple work surfaces.
How many projects do you have going at any given time?
It changes a lot. So right now I'm working on a house that's from Watertown, South Dakota. All of the stained glass windows from that house. It's a house that was purchased years ago, moved to a cornfield, repurchased by someone. Wow. And they're moving it out of the cornfield back to Watertown. And in the process, they pulled all of the stained glass windows to be restored before they're put back in the house. So it's kind of a done and done deal. So the windows you see around here, these are crates. This is a crate full of windows here from that house. They're all packed away again, but they're all from this one house. It's a mansion built by a banker who wanted to demonstrate to the local people that they could have some sophistication.
Are there a lot of specialty tools here? I see a lot of tools that I have in my workshop.
Yeah, there are a few specialty tools. We not only use a glass cutter, but we use, it's the wheel itself that has a certain bevel and angle and sharpness to it. When it comes to cutting glass and holding glass, you have pliers. These are called grozing pliers, G-R-O-Z-I-N-G. The bad news is it's not in the Scrabble dictionary, so you can't use that, but that's the real name. There are special soldering irons that we use.
I see a big one over here.
This is a real industrial grade. This is about a $200 soldering iron, really nice though. We use a diamond router, so this is for helping to kind of dress the glass, to modify the sizing a little bit to get a more precise fit.
I wondered what this machine was.
It spits out water. So that
it does.
Keeps the dust down. And then the most important tool that often gets overlooked, when you do a stained glass window, there's a pattern, a line drawing, right? Mm-hmm.
Taking the rubber band off some parchmenty-looking things?
These are rubbings from the old windows, but if I just cut this single line with a pair of regular scissors and then use that piece of paper as a template to cut glass, every time I put a piece of lead between each piece of glass, my window grows. So instead of cutting the drawings with regular scissors, I cut the drawings with three-bladed scissors that remove space between each piece to accommodate the lead.
That takes about a 16th of an inch?
About a 16th of an inch, and depending on the lead that you're using, we have different size scissors in terms of how much they take or don't take.
And so you don't want the window to grow, do you?
No, you want to manage that. You'd like it to be the right size when you're done, hopefully square when you're done.
Yes.
You'd like it to fit to where it's supposed to go.
Especially in the restoration stuff, right? Okay, let's plop ourselves here and continue our conversation. Well, tell me about how you're educated in this. Are you self-educated? Did you go to art school? What happened?
I am completely self-taught. When I left high school and I went to community college, my first class in the morning at 8 o'clock was a Spanish class. And I'd taken a little bit of Spanish in high school, so I thought this would be easy. And as I sat down and looked around, I realized that I was surrounded by young girls in miniskirts. And coming from a seminary where there were no young girls, I was immediately overwhelmed and realized that I would never be able to consciously pursue my education without major distractions. So I quit going to school after a couple of years, was a photographer, a photo technician, wasn't very good at that, and had always wanted stained glass windows, so I just started putzing with it. Bought a bunch of scrap glass, tried to make a window. It was a disaster. Tore it apart, remade it again, still a disaster. Tore it apart, made it again, threw it away. Instead, started buying pieces and parts of old windows and trying to fix those, at which point I was more immediately successful.
And at that point in life, you did envision it being a vocation?
I did, because when I left my photo job, I was screaming, I quit, and my boss was screaming, you're fired. I was really tired of working for other people. I really, if at all possible, wanted to be able to work for myself unless I proved that I just couldn't. So I didn't really decide to be a stained glass artist, craftsman, person. I decided to be self-employed. And the only thing that interested me that I thought might be viable was stained glass.
Well, let's talk about, because you do two different kinds of things. You do originals, and then you do preservation and repair and restoration. So let's talk about the originals first. The process of making an original stained glass, are they usually windows?
Yeah. I'm a window person as opposed to a lamp person. I'm a window guy.
You're not a Tiffany guy.
Guy. No, I don't have the patience. I don't see things quite that way.
Does it start with a drawing? Do you draw first?
I'm usually triggered by materials. Oh. I will see a piece of glass. I'll see something that leaves an impression on me of an idea. If it sticks, I'll try to draw that, and I'll work on it. If it's for me, I can take it or leave it. In a sense, I can have drawings that might sit for years and I never use them. If it's for a customer, that's how things begin. They tell me what they want in the sense that they look at what I've done before. They say, I like this, I don't like that. And usually you get an impression in your mind's eye, and you try to bring that to life with a drawing. Glass samples, often you go back and forth where you make modifications to your idea so that they can buy into it, so to speak.
You hesitated a while ago to use the word artist. You qualified it. Person, craftsman, etc. But actually, I think you, from my perspective, can be labeled as an artist. Stained glass is, to me, very much like painting. It's just slower.
Absolutely. So if you go back to stained glass being an architectural element in the Middle Ages, right, you look at the bulk of painting that was being done at that time, either frescoes on the walls or painting on glass. The glass itself was detailed with painting, but it, in a sense, became more than a painting. It became a way to paint the light and to change the space. So I think of myself as an artist, but I had to get there. I had to earn that. I could more easily demonstrate my craftsmanship, whereas artistry is a tougher bar to make.
I don't think the word stained is very complimentary. Synonyms for it are discolored, blemished, tarnished, defiled. I think you could say tinted or dyed or shaded. What do you think about my issue there?
Well, I like the idea that you take issue, that you're concerned. Where the word comes from is a very actually specifically technical aspect. When they developed the ability to take glass, typically more of a clear glass, and apply silver nitrate to it, fire that in a kiln, pull the piece of glass out, wash off the residue of the silver nitrate, all of a sudden where the silver was, the glass has been stained or changed color to yellow or gold. So real stained glass in the purest sense refers to that use of painting and firing and tinting the glass through the application of metals or oxides or whatever. Your definition of stained actually is really good in that one of the reasons that they would take the glass, whatever color it was, and they would do all kinds of things to the surface to kind of mottle it or dapple it or muddy it up was to control the light so that when you're sitting in church and the sun comes up, it doesn't quite blister you with the brightness of light. So the application of paints and stains to the glass created opportunities for detail. It also created an opportunity to modulate the amount of light coming through everything in a window.
We're enjoying the coziness of an early afternoon in Monarch Studios in Menominee, and it is inhabited by one Michael Pila, who is a wonderful stained glass artist, craftsman, person. Special kinds of glass. Where do you get your stuff? Are you kind of a connoisseur when it comes to that?
I am very fond of the mouth-blown German antique glass. The mouth-blown glass has a different optical range than glasses that are machine-rolled or even hand-rolled. Because I think of myself as an artist who works with light and color in architecture, I want to get the light to do very dynamic, specific kinds of things. The Lambert's antique glass is the best at doing that.
Now back to me likening what you do to painting. I was thinking to myself, all right, a painter has a palette. They know that they want a certain color, and on that palette, they can mix colors to get a certain shade of blue. Can you do that with glass? I mean, do you have like a million colors of glass, or doesn't what shade of color blue it is matter in what you're doing?
We are typically limited by what we can get our hands on. So let's say that the factory in Germany, they're in-house sample set consists of more than 5,000 different colors. However, you don't get to buy necessarily directly from the factory. You're typically buying from an importer who tries to realistically carry a palette that is maybe 500 colors. So you're often working with what you become used to working with, what you know you can get. Within each sheet, there's variation. You can kind of play up and down in a certain range. But basically, you're working with a much more limited palette than what a painter could do.
Michael Pila, our guest here on Spectrum West and Wisconsin Public Radio. We're in his studio, Monarch Studios, in Menominee on a rainy day. Let's get to the preservation and the restoration part of what you do. Tell me about that practice. Is it a more meticulous practice than starting from scratch?
Yeah, it's a very distinct discipline. You're dealing with another craftsman's world. You get a window that needs work. It's usually tired, sagging, bowing, broken, whatever. Your responsibility is to do everything you can to hold on to all of the original glass, if at all possible. If the window needs to be re-leaded, which means you're going to dismantle it, clean all the glass, put it back together with new lead, you need to replicate the profile or the shape of that lead came so that it doesn't alter how things fit together. When you get done, it needs to go back into where it came from. It has to be the right shape, the right size, and hopefully have another 100 years of life before someone else has to work on it again.
What kinds of things impress us now with what kinds of things you've had to work on? What's been your biggest project? Has it been like one huge church you had to replace everything? Was there one giant window? And do you do it all here, or do you go on site to work as well?
The on-site work is typically just removal and reinstallation. Okay. So it's hard to work on windows on-site. Okay. It's a different set of skills, and it's a different way of doing things. Okay. I think that the largest restoration projects I've been involved with are often these days as a consultant as opposed to doing the work myself. So the windows at the Church of the Immaculate Conception in Kansas City, Missouri, I oversaw the work of all the restoration of those windows. And there are a number of projects like that where you get involved with an architect, and you're kind of acting as the owner's representative in that case. And that's more where I'm at these days as opposed to trying to have a team of people. I'm also old enough that I don't want to work that hard. Restoration to me, in many ways, is more demanding and stressful than building new work.
Do you take on work from people? I mean, now we're back to the original stuff. How somebody says, boy, I'm impressed with the way that guy talks, and I'd love to see his work, and I'm going to go look at his website. How often does that happen to you, where people come out of the woodwork and say, I have a window that I want to become stained glass, and you're the guy?
So I get calls often, being in Menominee now, I'm a little less visible than I used to be. And there's a part of me that isn't willing to work hard enough to be more visible. So this could be helpful. But I have always been someone who has been more interested in trying to do truly original work rather than doing something that I've already seen or that the customer has already seen. At the same time, I need to eat and pay my bills, etc. So the way that I kind of control my destiny is that I've aligned myself with a number of architects. And if I'm going to do work that is historically accurate or more or less original to me, if I'm doing it in league with other professional designers, I know that it's more likely to still be good work from me.
Michael Pila, thanks. Appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you very much.
Man, do I have a good job. Monarch Studios in Menominee. Michael Pila there for you. Spectrum memos for you. Auditions for new members of the Phipps Festival Chorus will be Wednesday and Thursday, September 5th and 6th from 7 to 8 p.m. TheFipps.org is that website. Fall music ensembles at UW-Eau Claire, Barron County. That's the new name. Begin rehearsal soon, and you can join the Communiversity Band. They rehearse Mondays beginning September 10th. The Red Cedar Choir rehearses Thursdays beginning September 6th. The North Winds British Brass Band practices Sundays starting October 7th. And individual piano lessons are available beginning September 17th. Hey! Take note, Spectrum Westerners, we will not be around next week. We're hitting the pause button, but we'll return September 13th with an all-new program. And then the following week, we'll help ramp up the excitement for the grand opening of the sparkling new Pablo Center at the Confluence in Eau Claire. Cora, Kate, and Colin back again deserve and get some gratitude, and I'm grateful that you all spend some time with us today and every week when you can. Repeating, have a fun and safe Labor Day weekend. For Jim Oliver, I'm Al Ross. Bye.